Hello out there, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes College Radio. Today is Wednesday, October 31st, 2012. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and here in the USA, it's Halloween, and I'm in costume. Are you? It's time. It's time to get in costume. Come on. Once a year, you're allowed to look bizarre on the street, and people don't notice. The show, as always, is dedicated to writers, books, and publishing, and my guest today for the entire hour is Arthur Plotnick. He's been on before with a couple of his previous books, and I'm always happy to have him back on. He has a background in editing and publishing. His bio is about 2 miles long. Two of his works have been featured as Book of the Month Club selections. The Elements of Editing is a standard reference. It's been through some 20 printings. And The Elements of Expression, Putting Thoughts into Words, is what he's here to talk about today. It's revised and expanded and published in July, this past July. Came out a long time ago. It's a standard as well. He was on for Spunk and Bite. That was a few years ago, A Writer's Guide to Bold Contemporary Style, and it's another standard. And then I think early in 2011, I think it was, he was on with Better Than Great, a plenitudinous compendium of wallopingly fresh superlative. See, I'm going to punish him now. I'm going to bring him on, and I'm going to punish you, Art, for that title.
What'd you get for a plenitudinous introduction? My plenitudinous.
Thank you.
Biography.
Yeah. It's so long. You have done so much. This biography goes on to the second page. You even wrote pulp novels.
Yeah, I wrote 20 pot boilers, as we called them then.
Was that how you started writing? What was your entree into the world of publishing?
Publishing, I think. Fourth grade in the local newspaper's junior section. You know, I had to be linguistically large, because I was kind of a slight kid among big people.
So, is that true, though? You were into words and language from the start?
Yeah, except I probably wouldn't have said I was. I was just being a wise guy and funny and being liked, trying to be liked. And words turned out to be a path, I think. A lot of writers have the same motivation. You want to be liked, and you find something you're good at.
Yeah, it's interesting.
But then it becomes much more than that, a cause in itself.
Mm-hmm.
But happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. Are you in costume?
I am in a writer's costume. Writer's funky T-shirt. dad jeans.
Oh, I love Halloween. I tell you, when I was a kid, I had 3 costumes. So we started, I got my mother to take me out 3 days before to the far reaches of the neighborhood. No one was ready, but I was. And because I had 3 costumes, I had two.
Well, you know, the world wants to know which costume you used for the party that you alluded to on Facebook.
Oh, I was a plastic surgeon from Mars. So I was wrapped in plastic. I was in a surgeon's outfit, and I was painted green.
That was this year? I saw the picture. Okay.
Yeah, that was this year. I had a little doctor's kit. If anybody needed a lift or a tuck, I could have done it.
So you turned down the Martian prom queen and the pirate.
Yeah, I turned those down.
Surgeon from Mars.
Yeah. In my neighborhood, you know, there's a lot of plastic surgeons, but none are from Mars. So, you know, I had to do that. But that's enough about me. I have a question. I have a really important question, and it's a mystery. And I hope you can help me, because there was a piece in the LA Times, I think it was last week, and I don't know who wrote it. Maybe it was you. But somebody, a grammarian, was writing about the words maybe and perhaps. And I looked for it. Someone alerted me to it, and I couldn't find it. But I guess there's a lot of controversy over using these two words, and when it's really appropriate to use maybe, and when it's appropriate to use perhaps. Can you enlighten us on this one?
Well, I wish I'd read that article. I'm always wrestling with it. It's a big leap, and we don't have many synonyms for maybe. You go, perhaps, what else do you have? But it's a big leap in diction, isn't it? Maybe is so colloquial.
It is.
And perhaps is kind of elite, perhaps.
A little more poetic.
Well, a little more elegant or eloquent. Perhaps I might. I mean, would you say that on the street? Hey, you got a you got a cigarette, man? Perhaps. So it's, you know, it's a matter of audience and the context. I think I use perhaps too much because maybe some certainly seems. Pull things down a bit, but
well, it's true. When you're writing, I'll use it in writing, but it's true. I rarely say the word.
What did the article favor?
I don't know.
Oh,
I couldn't find it. If anybody out there saw it, let me know what issue, what page. Yeah, I couldn't find it. So I have no idea. But I find myself.
That's a good one, because you know there aren't many words that. Don't have a load of synonyms and alternatives. I can't think of a single one offhand quickly. I'm sure your listeners are ticking them off for maybe, I suppose, or something. But there's another word like he shrugged, she shrugged, which writers use so much in shtick for dialogue. What's the synonym?
Yeah,
what's tossed the synonym? Her shoulders. There's no one word.
No, I wonder why. Well, I was just thinking of because I misspelled weekend on, you know, I was writing to somebody and I spelled it weakend, and I thought, oh, maybe the Saturday and Sunday are the weekends of the week, and is that why it's weekend with W-E-E-K?
Yeah.
I mean, you just have me thinking about words, you know?
The feeble end. The frail end.
The frail end. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I am with Arthur Plotnick today, talking about primarily the elements of expression, but all of his books, all of his stuff, all of his writings, and you know, I think after you were on the last time with the title I can't pronounce, I found
Thunderstudentist Compendium of Wallopingly Fresh Superlatives.
You must have really practiced that one.
Every day.
I found that I either had the Elements of Expression, the original version on my shelf, or I found it somewhere. And then I was happy to see that you brought it out again, the expanded and the revised and expanded. Tell me about that. Tell me why it came out once again, revised and expanded.
Well, my publisher thought I should do a new edition, and I was kind of, well, you know, I said what I had to say there, and the core message I didn't think had changed that much of getting thoughts into words. And how to do it and why you do it and prompting people to do it. But as I read through the old edition, I just saw so many things that were kind of getting creaky because, 96? So 16 years had passed, 15 years, when I wrote it. And the competitive environment for writers had changed, the whole digital thing had changed, a lot of the phrasing and references I was using had become stale, as so easily happens. I took out a whole chapter on electronics, because had a lot of cringy terms, you know, like cathode ray tubes or something. And I added many sidebars and an extra chapter that pretty much were inspired by dozens, scores of columns I'd written since for The Writer and Spunk and Bite. and better than great. So it's a much more, I think, contemporary book now with a lot of extra features.
Will you read from it?
I could, but I wanted to just offer a Halloween word before we get off the Halloween subject, if I might.
Sure.
Yeah, I have a good one. You Halloween fans. Horripilating. Do you know that word?
I don't know that word.
Yeah, it's a good one. It means makes your hair stand up. On your arms, could be like goosebumps, bristle. So I looked it up. You know, it's a good one for Halloween. It's horripilating. Your plastic surgeon from Mars is horripilating. It comes from the Latin horrere, H-O-R-R-E-R-E, which means to bristle. And then I discovered that all the horror words have that hairy derivation. You know, hairy, hoary, hirsute, horror, horripilating.
How did you find this?
You know, messing around.
Messing around. So other people, like, get on the Internet, they go to Facebook, you go into books on language.
Yeah, I have enough here. I'm surrounded by them. It's claustrophobic. Killing me. But, you know, that's it. Linguistics isn't my real specialty. Even grammar isn't. You know, expressiveness is kind of my focus these days. That's it. Well, boggle. That's another interesting one. And then I'll get off linguistics. That's from the Scottish bogil, which is a goblin or ghost that startled horses. So when something boggles your mind, there's either a goblin around, or you may be a horse. Great, fascinating way.
Either of those options don't sound real good to me, but...
I was going to read something on Tough Talk, because that's a fun chapter in the Elements of Expressiveness. You know, Tough Talk is, it's a chapter you don't get everywhere in books on language, how to talk tough and why it's so expressive. Because Tough Talk is forceful, unlike other kinds of expression. It's forceful even when using stock phrases and common words, even stale ones, because it comes with such venom and menace.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just read a few lines here. Well, about a page, okay?
Okay.
Toughness, like all effects, can be a matter of precision, of picking words that hit the bullseye in nuance and sound. I ask for a drop-dead handsome, I get this plug-ugly mutt. Hardness comes also from syntax, which is word order, or grammatical patterns used by tough groups and individuals. The present habitual tense of to be is now part of standard American kidlish. Yo, I be telling you, Ma, don't be putting no carrot in my lunchbox. So IB is the present habitual tense. Don't be. Forceful as it may be, such American malediction is small change next to the vitriol of third world revolutionaries and of older societies. A Peruvian linguist has observed how the Shining Path rebel movement, quote, uses words like bullets, calling its enemies animal generals with worm-eaten brains, and the president of Peru, quote, the genocidal hyena whom we will frontally combat until we see him crushed like the filthy and obscene rat that he is. More subtle but no less scathing is the tough talk of Mandarin Chinese, poetic in its imagery. An offensive young upstart whom we would call a punk is dubbed, and I'm sure I'm pronouncing this all wrong, Ruko Waigan, in Mandarin, literally, milk stink not dry. Now, Hollywood needs lines like that. For example, Carlito's Way is a tough-talking film in which ex-con Carlito, Al Pacino, tells a young rival, you ain't like me, you a punk. Now for the tougher rewrite. You ain't like me, punk. You milk stink, not even dry. For all its malignancy, tough talk can also deliver benign messages in certain contexts. Break a leg, you stage-struck idiot, is a good wish in a tough casing. Tough talk can be directed to oneself, but the flagellation is meant to beat others to the punch, roughen the surface. The gumshoe greets the day with a bracing self-assault. When I came to, I looked like I'd spent the night with a kinky taxidermist.
Oh, that's funny.
Tough talk is, I think, surrounds us now on, you know, in HBO and all the tough shows and the cop shows, and it's just becoming part of our blood, rap, hip-hop. And if we're lucky today, you're going to hear my new self-referential, very brief hip-hop verse.
Oh, I want to hear that. Should we save that for the second half?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure can.
Okay. So, yeah, I love this little book. You know, I love all of your books, and I was noticing I have a copy of The Elements of Style that Myra Coleman illustrated. Which I particularly like because of her illustrations. But Spunk and Bite, your Spunk and Bite was a takeoff on Strunk and White. And
inspired by.
Talk about that. Talk about Spunk and Bite and how that one came to be and what your feelings are about The Elements of Style.
Yeah, well, I certainly respect Spunk and Bite, and I, you know, it played a great part in my learning to eliminate needless words, which is their mantra. As I got into many more kinds of writing, public relations, journalism, fiction, books, and so on, it began to seem kind of creaky and restrictive. You know, he's got a lot of restrictions up front. Don't do this, don't do that. It's largely what it's about. What not to do, restrain yourself. Don't use foreign language. Don't refer to me. Don't refer to yourself. So it's fine for freshman composition because you've got to calm down those students and all their hormones. But if you want to be expressive, you got to start breaking those rules. So although I still take a cold shower in Spunk and White every so often, I felt there were a lot of ways to go beyond his restrictions that enabled you to get a voice and get a style. You know, there's only one voice that's going to come out of Strunk and White, the kind of correct, lean, and clear style, which is fine, but it's not going to distinguish you in a very competitive, dynamic, crazy environment that we have today.
I'm trying to remember. I'm pretty sure. Well, I know Mark Twain had a view about adjectives, but Strunk and White talk about adjectives as well in writing. But what's your take on adjectives? Because I mean, you know, like your platitudinous book, of course, is all about sort of colorful sort of, you know, verbs, modifying verbs that are interesting.
Yeah, in a way, it's 6,000 synonyms for great.
Yes.
Pretty much all adverbs or adverbial expressions. You know, adjectives modifying adjectives become an adverb. Like awfully great, you know. So, I have no bias against adjectives. Or somebody said, when you see an adjective, kill it. Yeah, and Ben Yagoda, I think, picked that up in one of his very good books. But there's this general bias against adverbs and adjectives per se. which is ridiculous because they're words that give us information that can be funny, exciting, interesting. You just don't want to, like anything else, you don't want to overuse them, or you don't want to use them when they're not necessary. So, you know, you don't want to say extremely brilliant, because brilliant's already brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Or completely full, because full's already full. Now we're so tired of our words, because we hear them again and again, and we hear the stock language again and again. So we keep trying to intensify them, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and this book gives you, I mean, not that you know, as a writer you can't borrow some of these, but it really gets you thinking about how to combine words for effect. I mean, you know, beautiful, she's beautiful. Well, she's horrifyingly beautiful. I like that. You know, it's like, what does that mean on Halloween? That might really work. On another day, it might not. But
yeah, that's a little, you know, figure of speech, an oxymoron where it seems like a paradox.
But what I like, I think what I like about your stuff in general, and when I first discovered you in a conscious way, it was in the Writer magazine a few years back. I think must have been before you were on the show with any of your books, and you had written a piece for the Writer that had such an effect on me. I wish I still had it. It was about color, and I remember after I read it, I think I wrote to the editor, because I was doing a bit of writing for the Writer then too, and I just said that Art Plotnick is the bee's knees. I mean, my gosh. And Jeff or whoever, Ron, somebody, one of the editors there said, yeah, you know, he's the best. Because of your, you know, it's like you give permission to, you're a grammarian, and yet you give permission to sort of stand out, be colorful, really kind of put your stamp on your writing without having to worry about the rules so much.
Well, you flatter me. But, you know, it's mainly a case of paying attention to language and savoring it when you see something good, when you see someone describe a red as a hectic red, you know, or blue is the book of hours. These bring these common things to life. When you personify a color, it's an angry yellow, or a yellow that all the other yellows want it to be. Suddenly it's animated. When you see something like that, savor it, you know, chew it 32 times, like like some guy named Fletcher once advised for digestion that you should chew each morsel 32 times. Well, do it with words and put it in your journal. And then you get it into your soul
mm-hmm.
and start doing it yourself. But thanks for saying I was the bee's knees or the alligator's adenoids or the sardine's whiskers. I'll take those.
Oh, dear. We have to take a quick break. I can't believe a half hour has flown by. I'm so glad you're here for the entire hour.
Me too.
We will be right back. All of you out there, stay with us. Instead of our usual song that we usually play at this point in honor of Halloween, I'm going to play something else from my Godfather soundtrack, because I can't find anything else on disc scarier. I was looking for the Monster Mash or any of those scary, but they're all on my cassettes. I don't have any of them on disc or on the iPod. So let's see, why don't we play the Halls of Fear from the Godfather soundtrack. So stay with us, and Art, stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Hey, you like KUCI, right? Well, now's your chance to support the greatest station in the history of the universe. Starting November 2nd and going on through November 16th, KUCI will be holding its Fall Fun Drive. Show your support by pledging over the phone or even online through KUCI.org. From all of us here at KUCI, thank you for your support.
Yeah, the dirt on publishing, writers, authors, all of it. Listen.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And hello and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. And today's Halloween 2012. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett in costume in the studio. Not that anyone can see, but I will probably post a photo later. If you're my Facebook friend, you'll see it. And if you're not, it'll be somewhere. Anyway, not that you care, because so many people don't like Halloween anymore, Art. What are we going to do with that?
I think writers like it. It's a day when we are haunted by our characters.
Yes,
by the ghosts of works never written.
Oh, beguiled God.
By the lure of fame, crazed by the witch's brew of words that boils in our brains.
Well, you know, I was looking for Halloween stories to read, and I found actually a kid's book that I'm going to read later at the very end. But it's funny, it's such a great book with just rhythm and words and sounds. And then I looked on Amazon, because I bought it years ago for my kid when he was little, and you know, I like to buy thematic books, and now it's going for like, I don't know, it's out of print, it's $50 to $100 for this book, and it's just the best book, the best Halloween book. It's for adults and kids, so I'm going to read it later on.
Alrighty.
You inspired
that
too.
And then you should sell it.
Pardon me? I should sell it, I know.
Read it and sell it.
I should make a color copy for myself and sell the original, right? Oh, I can't do that. I just can't. But anyway.
You're on suffering pumpkin block. Last 2 or 3 years, I created these really expressive pumpkins using all the elements of expression. And they were characters, Michael Jackson with his glove, and Mona Lisa in a frame. Suddenly this year I block. Can't get inspired. I can't get an idea going. Can't get the energy. Does anyone have a solution for pumpkin block?
I don't know, but we have it at our house. We haven't even bought a pumpkin yet.
Maybe it's like everything, you know, gets overdone.
Gets overdone. We got to do it today, though. Got to do it.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, though, you know, it's funny you started talking about that, and I opened the book randomly to Chapter 13, Specialized Words, Stimulation for Every Occasion. And it looks like you added some stuff here. I see Song of Solomon in here. Was this in here in the original?
What page are we on?
Well, the beginning of the chapter's on 215, and Song of Solomon is 227, Language for Lovers.
Yes, some of that was in there.
But, you know, I'm wondering, too, you know, it's sort of like what I'm going through with some of my students right now. and one of my workshops is writing love scenes without them turning into romance novels or, you know, porn or, you know, choosing the words. You know, the word choices seem to have everything to do with it.
Boy, those are tough. So many non-novelists who became novelists, like Washington people, just collapse when they do a love scene. It's a real art, because so much of love talk is cliche, and you don't want your characters to to be cliche. Has to be exactly the right tone. But, you know, there are patterns to look at, and that's what this book offers. You know, patterns ranging from kind of nuance to bold faced passion. Sappho writes, sweat runs down in rivers, a tremor seizes all my limbs and paler than grass in autumn. Caught by pains of menacing death, I falter, lost in the love trance. Wow. Excuse me a minute, I catch my breath. But, you know, George Bernard Shaw, a little more literary. As you guess, Ellen, I am having a bad attack of you just at present.
I love that.
Yeah, a nice little locution.
Having a bad attack of you, that's good.
So you've been, you know, we learn to write by imitation. We learn to speak by imitation. And eventually we make it our own. We integrate it into our own personality.
What about personification? You mentioned it earlier in relation to something you were talking about, but what's your opinion on personification? Should trees breathe and look at you and stand silent as guards?
Yes. I love personification. It's not overdone. Especially when you don't expect something to be personified. You know, you can expect a tree to be personified, maybe. But like Martin Amis personifies a crackling fire, and other writer coffee on the stove, and how it's they're speaking, and I wish I had it in front of me, but suddenly it's a surprise. It's novel.
Mm-hmm.
It's fresh that this thing is being personified. When you, as I said, when you personify a color, it's a surprise.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember that article I'm talking about that you wrote for The Writer on color?
Yeah, way back.
Is that included in any books of yours that I can back to?
Yes, I think it's in Spunk and Bite.
Okay, I have to go back and look at
that. Yeah, intensify your colors. And then in the Better Than Great, has a sidebar on colors. See if I can find it real fast. I don't think so.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Let me just talk amongst yourselves.
If you just tuned in, as I always say at this time, you're a little bit late, but I'm with Art Plotnick, and his book that we're mainly focusing on today is the revised and expanded The Elements of Expression, Putting Thoughts into Words, published by Viva Editions. And this show, along with other shows, will be podcast on my website, penonfire.com, which is basically new website. The blog is now on the homepage, and so in a few days I hope to podcast this one. So if you're just tuning in, you can hear it in full. Okay.
Okay. We're talking about colors and intensifying them.
Yep.
And some of the examples I give are a green, green, green that makes you want to cry. Sandra Cisneros and Caramello.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Seismically red. Diane Ackerman.
Mm-hmm.
The achingly fluorescent green. Diane Ackerman again.
That's great.
Yeah. White as glacier milk. You can do it with a metaphor. White as glacier milk, Janet Fitch.
You know, it's hard thinking of new ways to express color, right? I mean, you know, his sea green, his seafoam eyes, or, you know, is her, you know, hair the color of, I don't know, horse's tail. No, I mean, no one would ever say that. But you know what I mean? It's like, it's there. You feel like they've all been used when you're actually writing. And to find new ones, what do you suggest?
Keep looking around and get it in your notebook. When you're in a dentist's office, look around. Look at the colors that are there that you could use for a metaphor, you know, the color of an x-ray, the color of a dentist's wall.
No, that's true, though. That's true. I mean, when we're, especially when you're in an environment that has a lot of that color, when you're in a medical office that, you know, maybe there's a lot of white.
Yeah, you're always going to be in some offbeat place that suggests something.
Or
off
gray.
The wall, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm thinking of Will Self's talking about sky the color of dog's lips. It's a, you know, there's a million things in the world, and there's always one you can pull out for a metaphor.
Well, you know, let's, I want to hear your, whatever you wrote that, you alluded to that you're going to, perform for us.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, this alludes to my, refers to my, writing as an older person. You know, I'm in a kind of a scary decade now, talking about scary things. But I'm trying to stay with it. I like writing. I like being in the field and having stuff out there and expressing myself. But it takes a lot of effort to not kind of dry up and lose your contemporary references and so on. But recently what got me thinking about it was some blog called Layman's Terms was talking about Spunk and Bite. And this is the kind of side-handed compliment they gave me. Quote, "And for an older dude, he's impressively not hilarious when using modern slang and idioms." So, you know, using them, but I'm not quite hilarious about it. But he liked it overall. But it inspired this rap tune, rap lyric, which maybe sums it all up.
Okay.
"Call me Tupac Plotnick with a fat pocket in my portfolio of writing. Not bad for an oldie trying to be more exciting than the young blood coming in the game, making a name, getting all G'd up from the feet up while I'm gone insane praying for a critic who don't know I'm arthritic." Kanye Plotnick.
That is just great. That's great. You know, what you were just talking about before you did that, which was just perfect, is, you know, in usual professions, people retire. In writing, I mean, one of the wonderful things about being a writer is that you never retire, or hopefully you never want to retire. I mean, it just seems like, you know, with all the arts, you can pretty much go until you drop, and You know, the idea of retiring has always struck me as such an odd thing to do if you like what you do. And so I also then kind of went to what writers experience in, say, Hollywood, which is ageism, and script writers maybe experience it less now, but still experience it. And so they kind of pair up with younger writers who will do the pitching so that the producers don't feel like they're hearing their father, mother, grandfather, grandmother pitch, you know. Yeah. But what do you think about ageism in writing, in books, in you know, publishing? Does it exist? I mean, certainly for you it doesn't exist.
Well,
because of your brilliance and your talent, but in general.
Yeah, but I'm sure it exists, and, you know, it exists for a reason. You feel that the older writers aren't going to appeal to that 25-year-old generation you're trying to reach, or that you imagine is you're trying to reach. Any sign of geezerism can be fatal. If your manuscript talks about records and your record player.
Although there's lots of them being sold again.
Yeah. You got to give it a new context. Or your email is AOL.com like mine.
Well, you can get away with it because you're famous.
Invested in it so long ago. So there is. And, of course, it's unfair because, you know, judgment is... And good writing is, in a way, the result of many. It's kind of the last skill you develop after many, many years, and confidence. So, you know, many writers do write to their 90s, and they're wonderful. But it's a struggle. I can see myself retiring from trying to get published, because that can be a young person's game after a while, all the promotion and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But never from writing, because we're always writing. We're writing in our heads and our blogs and our emails, and it's wonderful to express yourself. But I had jotted down some little thing I heard from on Garrison Keillor.
Mm-hmm.
That got me thinking it's on this subject. I'm going to give you a little piece of it here, okay?
Okay, yeah.
He's talking about fall in Lake Wobegon. And he says, it's been so beautiful. Gorgeous, gorgeous. Beautiful trees and this gorgeous air. It's a beautiful thing, a beautiful thing you discover as you get older, and you move away from the idea of making the world a better place. And you decide just to enjoy tomorrow, which once you stop trying to make it a better place, it may actually become a better place.
You even sound like him.
I'm trying. So that's the message, you know. And when you get older, you don't have to keep trying to keep up with what's the trends in publishing. So
mm-hmm.
You have confidence, and maybe as a result of less trying, you're going to really get your voice together and enjoy it. Make something enjoyable.
Yeah, so then kind of this topic segues into self-publishing a little bit, and I don't really want to spend much time on it because I don't really like self-publishing for mostly marketing reasons, I think, and also because self-published books that at least come to me for the show so often are full of typos and the covers are bad. But what's your opinion? Do you think at a certain point, if you try to market your stuff, an agent isn't taking it on, a publisher's not taking it on, you should self-publish?
Big question. You know, certainly if you want to leave a little mark for your family, you know, there are certain books, I'd say definitely, yes, if it's a family history or some non-fiction topic that you really want to leave as a legacy for whoever picks it up, sure, you know, get a couple of dozen copies out there in the universe. It doesn't cost that much anymore. It's not like these $10,000 con jobs there used to be. You know, it was a terrible thing, that industry, at one time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's an illusion that because two or three people self-published and they were picked up by major publishers after they hand-sold it by the thousands, it's going to happen easily. There's just obstacles at every point, you know, getting it into stores, getting anyone to promote it, listen to it. So, I don't know, I think it's worth trying to be as good a writer as you can and go the normal route.
Do you think if your stuff is good, you'll eventually get it out there, a publisher will pick it up, or do you think these days it's... You can be wonderful and they're going to pass because, say, literary writing is hard to market, or, you know, they're not buying any more vampire novels or whatever.
It could happen. You know, there are very good writers who just are not getting published. Even writers who got published before, sometimes that's even more of a disadvantage because their sales record is poor and everybody knows it now. You know, everyone has those figures from Nielsen surveys that the Nielsen whatever.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. The book, the numbers.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I wonder how many writers now are using pseudonyms, actually. You know, and putting out books under another name because of those numbers.
Yeah, isn't that terrible? That you instead of a track record, you have to hide from your track record. What a biz.
What a biz. What a biz.
But, you know, it's... has its rewards, and I always try to live by E.L. Doctorow's quote that the book gives you the gift when you write it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Publishing is a crapshoot. You can even get it published, and then there's the silence, even by a major publisher.
What about you? Have you been rejected?
Yeah, sure. I think every writer has a collection. But
my guess is your collection is teensy. Teensy weensy.
No, no. I write a lot. I send a lot. I get rejections. Nonfiction now, probably. If I stayed on the topic of writing, I could easily publish because I have a good track record there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a novel. I've tried a few novels. Didn't get published, although some of the short stories, some of the chapters got published as short stories. I've published a few memoirs lately and literary mags, op-eds, guest blogs, some poems. So it goes on. Some rejects, some successes. But the writing is the fun. The writing is where you get those thoughts out. And the elements of expression is where you learn to get those thoughts out.
Yeah. Well, I love this book, and I wonder if you'd even come back again in the next couple of months and talk a little more about words. It's always just so fun to have you on.
Well, you're the most fun host, as everybody knows.
Oh, yes, of course.
God, the list of people you've interviewed, I'm so humbled to be among them. That pantheon.
I'm humbled to have you on the show. So, anyway, we have to go. I'm gonna do this little Halloween story, and I'm gonna podcast the show, and then I'm gonna email you later and see if we can set up another time in the new year to have you back on.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Art Plotnick. His book is The Elements of Expression. All of his books are worth having on your shelf. You know, it's I refer to them, and I love them, and I won't let anyone borrow them because I think he's great. Okay, I'm going to read you a really quick little Halloween story. It's a Halloween story for kids, but you know, I think it's pretty cool. It's one of Travis's books that I get out and read, and especially at Halloween. That's what it is. So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put The Godfather back on as soundtrack, and I'm going to read The Rattlebone Rock to you. It's The Rattlebone Rock by Sylvia Andrews, illustrated by Jennifer Plickus. And this is how it goes. Folks in the town still talk of the night when the moon on the graveyard shone so bright that the spirits there made the tombstones knock and the beat began for the Rattlebone Rock. Boom-a-boom. Boom-a-boom. Skeletons danced and pranced around. They rattled their bones with a rhythmic sound. Clack-a-clack. Clack-a-clack. Ghosts swayed and lined to the beat of the bones and jazzed up the sound with musical moans. Ooh-a-ooh. Boo-a-boo. Ghouls jumped right in with a rapping rhyme and tapped on tombs to the boom-a-boom time. Rap-a-tap, rap-a-tap. Then a banshee rose and began to wail like the shriek of wind in a rollicking gale. Ee-ya-ee! Ee-ya-ee! And grisly goblins howled and hissed as the shuffle-shoe danced in the syncopating mist. Shoo-shoo-shap, shoo-shoo-shap. Weird witches, too, stirred a simmering brew and chanted spells while the boom beat grew. Ah-ha-ha! Ah-ha-ha! The beat was heard all through the town as windows shook and pots fell down and cradles swayed. Rock-a-rock-a! Rock-a-rock-a! And clocks ran wild. Tick-a-tock! Tick-a-tock! Everyone rushed outside to see what was making the town shake crazily. The townsfolk cheered when they saw the scene. It looked like the best ever Halloween, so they all joined in and stomped their feet. Even the mayor boogied to the beat. Bats swooped in the sky, squeak-a-squeak, squeak-a-squeak. And mice romped by, eek-eek, eek-a-eek. Cats made a din, meow, meow. And owls flew in, whoop-a-woo, whoop-a-woo. That boom-a-boom beat kept on and on, so everyone rocked till the light of dawn. Now folks still talk of that wild, wild night when the moon on the graveyard shone so bright that the spirits there made the tombstones knock and the whole town dance to the Rattlebone Rock. That was it, The Rattlebone Rock by Sylvia Andrews. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. You can catch the show again at penonfire.com. Going to leave you with a quote by John Selden, who said, "Syllables govern the world." Have a happy Halloween.